All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, good afternoon and another day at... Oh, okay, I'm getting signals from the studio. Well, all right, we got that one straight. This is Bob Gould welcoming you to Veterans Radio, another edition of Veterans Radio coming live from the studios of WAAM in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is the garden spot of the Midwest. Boy, we had a great day yesterday. Anyway, we won't even get into that. We got a great program today. We got Rebecca Grant. We got Kevin Hemel. Wow. All sorts of things. So we're going to be leading off right now. Here at Veterans Radio, we want to get veterans employed. We want to get information for them to being employed. We want to make sure that veterans get every opportunity that they can to succeed. One of them is coming up on October the 22nd. That's right, October the 22nd at... I've got to get this thing straight here. Where is this? It's going to be in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And it's going to be the 22nd at 10 o'clock. And, oh, Michigan Works. There we are. Okay. Came out a little light. The Michigan Works at 304 Harriet Street, Ypsilanti, Michigan. Got it? 304 Harriet Street, Ypsilanti, Michigan. Now, what's going to happen there? Resume preparation, mock interviewing. Haircut. Wouldn't that be cool? Bus tokens to get to your interview and interview clothing. Everything you need to be successful. You're thinking, you know, I can't get started. I don't have a suit. I don't have a tie. I don't even have a haircut. They'll do all of that. That's going to be on October the 22nd at Michigan Works in Ypsilanti, 304 Harriet Street, Ypsilanti, Michigan. It's called the Hire the Michigan Veteran Preparation Day. Well, what's it in preparation for, Bob? Well, right here, there's going to be a hiring event for veterans and also for their families, not for the, but they can be there, at the Washtenaw Community College Morris Lawrence Building, November 3rd, right? So you go on the 22nd in Ypsilanti. Do I have a phone? Yes, here's the phone number for the one on the 22nd, 734-975-6880, 734-975-6880. That's going to be all about the prep, you know, the haircut, the clothing, the interview, the practice. You know, I know you know how to do that, but it gives you confidence, and that's what it's all about. When you want to get hired, and everybody's equal, the one that's got the confidence is the one that's going to get the job. We're going to be right back with Kevin Hemel, Rebecca Grant, right here on Veterans Radio. Don't you go away, right after this very important message. Yeah, we had to get that last note in. We're back here on Veterans Radio, and with me now a frequent guest. We also see him on the Military Channel, on the History Channel. He's written several books. Patton's photographs, one that we've covered here on the program. Patton's photograph, and Patton, legendary World War II commander. Kevin is author of both those books. By the way, if you're looking for something for Christmas, we've got books, folks. We're going to be talking a lot about books, and that's a gift that just keeps on giving, right, to the veteran. Hey, what do I get for the veteran? Well, that's what, one of the things that you can get for the veteran. Kevin Hemel is a former historian for the U.S. Army Combat Studies Institute. He wrote military history narratives on the war in Afghanistan. Ooh, Bananistan, Afghanistan. What the heck is going on there? He, of course, I mentioned the books that he is an author. He's presently working on a book. Well, we're going to be presenting that today, focusing exclusively on Afghanistan. He did finish that. And now he is working with the Air Force Department as a journalist and a journalist. Oh, Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob. Good to hear your voice. How you doing?
I'm doing great. And what is your position called?
I am a journalist for the Air Force's Medical service, the Air Force Medical Service. And so I am basically writing articles about airmen and the medical service of the U.S. Air Force. And it's quite interesting and very exciting to work with them.
By the way, Kevin, would you please email me your new address, because we have a little gift from I know, he just moved, folks. He moved to Virginia. Yeah,
that's not, I love how we're taking care of administrative duties here on the radio, on air. That's fine. Sure, Bob, I'll be happy to.
Well, the Zingerman folks, beginning this week, are now going to be, for our guests, are going to receive a gift certificate from Zingerman's Delicatessen, Zingerman's online, Zingerman's.com, the world's foremost deli, worldwide deli. And I think you're going to love it, Kevin. So please send me your new number. Okay, let's get on with this new book I got here. And good Lord, Strikers in Afghanistan, a story of the 1st Battalion, 17th Infantry Regiment in Kandahar Province, 2009. Kevin, tell us all about that.
Sure. The 1st Battalion, 19th Infantry, also known as the 1st of the 17th, commanded by John Newman, was sent over as part of the mini-surge by President Obama to provide security for the elections in 2009, the presidential Afghanistan election. And this unit, in fact, their entire brigade, had been preparing to ship off to Iraq when they received notice that they would be going to Afghanistan. So they had their mission changed and arrived in Afghanistan just, you know, barely a week before the elections, and were given this onerous task of getting out into the countryside, securing these places where people were going to go vote, and then tap down the Taliban in the days before and after. It was quite challenging, but they had a unique weapon, which was the Striker, this relatively new army vehicle. It's an eight-wheeled, medium-armored vehicle. There were primarily for carrying infantry, but they had machine guns, grenade launchers. There was a version with a cannon, a version with a mortar on it. And so it was this sort of new way of fighting, because the Army realized a lot of the action that had taken place in the late 20th century involved towns and cities, and so you didn't want those big heavy tanks with tracks. You know, you could use vehicles that the wheel structure had become strong enough that it could be used in armor. And so the concept for this was to get armor anywhere around the globe, an entire, you know, brigade within a certain amount of days. And this was the brainchild of General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff at one point. And so this Striker battalion, part of a larger brigade, arrived north of Kandahar and spreads out and really goes toe-to-toe with the Taliban in some pretty brutal fighting. And when people think of Afghanistan, I think they think mountains, high altitude, where southern Afghanistan, you're really looking at lush green areas, wide open deserts, more flat lands. And these Strikers kind of really, and the men, you know, fighting with them, really have to kind of prove themselves in this very trying environment. So that's really what the book is about.
Okay, but let's draw the difference between the Striker and the Bradley fighting vehicle.
Sure. The Striker is going to weigh a lot less than a Bradley. It's going to fit more men. And one element that proved very important both in Afghanistan and even more so in Iraq, because it wasn't pulling large treads like a Bradley does, the engine was a lot quieter, and the men found they could fight and maneuver, and surprise the enemy much better than in a Bradley, and even travel up and down rivers. At one point, the entire battalion or elements of the battalion go on an assault down a river to completely surprise the Taliban. And so it's a more versatile vehicle. It's lighter and can carry more men. So you can see that it's much more infantry-centric. It's really going to help the infantry in their mission on the battlefield.
Okay, I'm looking here. Why wasn't this made in this country? It's made in Canada. Why do we have to buy Canadian and not make this vehicle in America? Did we have something lined up and it didn't get passed by Congress? What's going on?
No, originally when the U.S. Army was experimenting with the concept of the Striker, the Canadians were already using medium-armored vehicles, as well as several other countries. And in the testing phases, we found that it was better to simply borrow the Canadian strikers and develop from there than to start the whole program from scratch.
What was the strikers battalion's mission completely? They were there. How many were in the striker battalion?
You're looking at about 300 men
and
in a
women.
Battalion. And men and women in a battalion. Well, this was a combat unit, so I don't know that there were any women in the unit in 2009 when I was covering it or when I was conducting interviews. But you're looking at about 300 men, and the number of strikers is I can't grasp off the top of my brain, and I don't want to be wrong. But, you know, you're looking at about, you know, 16 men in a striker. I mean, it was rather large and carry a large contingent of soldiers. You know, so it definitely had, like I said, that advantage over the Bradley. And, you know, a simple company would consist of 14 strikers. So you can imagine, you know, when a striker platoon or an entire company is on the assault, there would basically be a phalanx of armored vehicles heading right at you on the attack.
Okay. You have on one of your bullets here. What was the greatest challenge facing the American soldiers? Of course, stay alive, right? Right, and not get injured. But what did you write down here? Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I would say the greatest challenge was the bringing security to the elections in that southern part of Afghanistan. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, because that, you know, the surge had been successful in Iraq under President Bush, and so when President Obama was presented with the situation in Afghanistan, he chose to do his own surge, and this was sort of a mini surge before the larger one because the election was under incredible jeopardy. The Taliban had really conducted their own surge, and districts that had been clear to the Taliban for the first election were slowly falling like dominoes and back into the Taliban hands, and something needed to be done to allow for a fair election.
The book, Strikers in Afghanistan, Combat Studies Institute Press. Combat Studies Institute Press, folks. U.S. Army Combat Arms Center, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. I was there. No, I wasn't a shut-in. I was actually there. But tell us a little bit about how somebody can receive this tome and how you got involved in it. And why don't you give us all that information?
Sure. I'll tell you how to get the book first. I'll tell you a little history. I'll repeat how to get the book. Your best bet is to get this online. There's an online version. All you got to do is Google Strikers in Afghanistan, CSI, for Combat Studies Institute, and you can download it. The Army did publish the book, but it was in limited numbers, so only DOD and Department of Army people can really get their hands on it. But for anybody interested in what these medium armored vehicles could do, you'd want to just Google Strikers in Afghanistan, CSI. You can download it immediately. It's a PDF file. And the Afghan study team itself, I should tell you, this was the brainchild of General Petraeus. He wanted soldiers to be able to read narratives and on their way to Afghanistan, basically, and understand what the fighting was going to be like, and even for soldiers there. And he didn't want field manuals. He wanted narratives, stories that soldiers could read. And this was something very important to him. And so what the Army did is they pieced together a small task force, I guess you could call it, historians, and headquartered us all at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And we just went in up to our elbows interviewing soldiers, creating stories on the platoon, company, and battalion level. It was fascinating work, found out all kinds of details of sort of the modern battlefield that the U.S. Army faces. We spent about 2.5 years developing these books called the Vanguard of Valor series for the Army and for the soldiers to prepare for Afghanistan.
I have heard, and I've talked to other historians, I've talked to other experts, consultants, and they say Afghanistan is the key to the Middle East. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's both the key to the Middle East and almost a black hole that it dares you not to enter because, you know, you're not looking at a centralized, strong government. You're looking at tribes that do not take kindly to foreigners, especially foreign fighters. The Russians, the British, the Americans have all found difficulties in that section of the world. but I guess the climate, the atmosphere, and the locals are quite a shadow of the rest of the Middle East. You know, it's that kind of world that Americans face when they touch down in the Middle East. This sort of strong tribalism that they face by the indigenous people, the terrain that can go from, you know, jungle to mountaintops, from below freezing temperatures to temperatures as high as 130 degrees in the south. And it's just a very tough place to fight, and a culture very different from ours and sort of Western society. And if you can wrap your mind around all of Afghanistan, you'll have a better understanding of the Middle East in that region.
Well, the Russians were fighting them, and the Taliban and the Americans. We had, Bing West was on, and he wrote the book, The Strongest Tribe. And what he said was, the folks are going to follow whoever keeps electricity on and the water running and the food coming in. It almost gets down to that. But, okay, so we are talking about that. Why don't you give that address one more time where folks can, and there's no charge for this publication. Guys, those of you that are military files and you, oh, boy, I like reading this stuff. Kevin, give them that address again.
Sure. It's simply just Google Strikers in Afghanistan Combat Studies Institute, and you'll be able to get a PDF that you can download and read at your own convenience.
Okay. What about ground support from the air? What did your research show on that, especially the A-10, the hog, as they call it? What about
sure.
that?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, that with the Stryker unit that I was covering, they mostly used helicopter support. But I did do two other stories about the 101st Airborne, and when they were stationed in Afghanistan, the A-10 was ideal to the ground situation. They had specific airmen and other soldiers on radios communicating with A-10s, calling them in for ground support. I did a study on a scout platoon that was basically fought surrounded for 2 days at a little OP called OP Dusty, and the A-10s came in and just did ground strike after ground strike and really held the Taliban off from overrunning this outpost. So the A-10, I would have to say, was instrumental in a lot of the success of the ground forces in Afghanistan.
We're going to take a quick break. Kevin, stay on the line. I'd like you to be on this interview with Dr. Rebecca Grant, who's coming on in just about 30 seconds, right, folks? Let's take a quick break. Let's go to Legal Help. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Don't you go away. Yeah, that's it. Nothing can beat the Air Force. And with us right now, many times been on the program, Dr. Rebecca Grant, political expert. Dr. Grant is director of the General Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power Studies at the Air Force Association and contributing editor for the Air Force magazine. Boy, we got questions today. Wow. Dr. Grant is senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. She earned her Ph.D. degree in international relations from the London School of Economics, oh, it was a bit foggy over there, and worked for RAND in the United States Air Force. In 1995, Dr. Grant founded IRIS, that's right, IRIS, Independent Research, that's right, and she has been the Air Force person that crunches all that information, comes up with all the solutions and the answers, and that's what we need right now. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob, and hi, Kevin. Nice to be back on Veterans Radio.
Well, before we go to break, real quick, I know I want to get into all this that's going on in Syria, Turkey, and what, but I want to talk about the A-10. I know that that's your one of your bailworks, and when you talk about the Air Force, and it just recently was kicked in the butt, and they got some more funding. And by the way, we have Selfridge Air Force Base just to the north of here, and that has a whole squadron of A-10. So it's very important. Why don't you tell us about that, Dr. Grant?
The A-10. I'm holding in my hand right now a shot glass made from an expended 30-millimeter shell that was used by an A-10 in Operation Desert Storm all those years ago. So big fan of the A-10. Of course, the question is how much longer, and the Air Force has made plans for the last few years to retire the A-10. Congress says no, let's keep them around for a while. We've got some good units doing that. But, you know, I think down the road it's a big question. And I want to tell you, Bob, the questions about the use of the A-10 in Syria. So the Air Force has confirmed that it's used the A-10s many times in Syria, but, you know, they've been very limited, and it's interesting to me as to why. General Hawk Carlisle, who is the head of Air Combat Command, puts it pretty succinctly. He says, you know, for one thing, the stationing of the A-10s is an issue, but really it's about their survivability in a contested environment. So the Air Force says the days of the A-10 are numbered.
Well, but what is the latest? For another 4 years, 3 years, the funding?
Yeah, it's for a few more years. And, you know, even the Air Force's original retirement plan expected to keep the A-10s in the inventory until about 2019. I think the issue for the Air Force, one, is they know that the A-10 can't be used in all the places where we're going to find heavy air defenses in the future. And two, they'd like to take some of the A-10 units, and particularly their great young crew chiefs, and start to train those A-10 maintainers over onto the F-35. So they want to be able to make that change and to go ahead and look at retiring the A-10 in favor of some other systems. But for the moment, Congress has said, keep it going. They gave the Air Force the funding. There's a member of Congress, Representative Martha McSally from Arizona. She is retired from the Air Force as a colonel. She's a former A-10 pilot. And she introduced legislation to bar the retirement of the A-10 and make it against the law to do that. So this is a decision that we'll see played out between the Air Force and the Pentagon and Congress, I think, probably over the next several years. We have not seen the end of this fight with the A-10.
And that is, I think, probably financial, because here in Michigan we have a whole squadron. I don't know how many does that mean, but it is the mainstay of Selfridge Air Force Base here in just outside north of Detroit, Michigan. And so what you're saying, though, is that the fight is still there, and we might even see beyond 2 years?
We might see that, and of course Selfridge is a great unit, no question about that. Typical squadron sizes between 18 and 24 aircraft. But you know, the question really is, 10 years from now, where do we want Selfridge and the other units to be? Will they have A-10s? Not likely, I'd say, in the long term. So when does a transition take place? But you know, we know the A-10 has a tremendous war record, and it certainly the A-10 lives on for the next few years. Longer term, though, I think we will eventually see that system retired out of the Air Force inventory.
Now, are you saying that perhaps they could be the squadrons replaced with X-35s? Is that right?
You know, there are a bunch of different ideas that the Air Force has had. One certainly is F-35s. We have a lot more of those coming, and some units have been announced, but not all by any means. The other option is to replace them with unmanned vehicles, which, of course, unmanned vehicles need almost as much human care and maintenance as the manned aircraft. So there's always a good manning associated with an unmanned unit. And there are other missions as well. So it really varies base by base as to what the Air Force's plans are. However, the Air Force's plans, Congress has made it very clear that Congress will determine when the A-10 leaves the inventory and will determine the fate of specific units, at least for the next couple of years. That is what we will see.
We have about
very strong on the Hill.
We have about 45 seconds. Is Congress friendly with the Air Force?
Yes, overall, absolutely. But this is just a case where there is a disagreement on the proper role for the A-10 right now. So I think we'll continue to see him fight on this one.
Okay. Well, we got 30 seconds to go. Why don't we have a little chin music there? Yeah, that's it, Derek. Derek's got it under. Dr. Rebecca, please stay around. Kevin, please stay around. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio, WAAM 1600. Go get a coffee, but come right back in about 5 minutes. We're back on Veterans Radio. Yeah, we get that last beat, right, folks? Right, folks. And we're here. We're talking about Afghanistan. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about what the heck is going on there. Raise your hands, everybody who understands this. Raise your hand. Yeah, okay, I don't see very many hands. So here's Putin. Putin gets it. The Russians are coming in. What? I mean, here we have the Russians. We tell Putin, you better stay, Putin. Stay where you are. Don't do any of this. Let's talk. No, he goes ahead and starts shooting at the very rebels, unless I got this wrong, the very rebels that we are supporting in Syria to overthrow Assad. And now we got the Russians who are going after the rebels who were fighting Assad. And now we've got the oh, gosh, what's going on here? Dr. Grant, tell us all about that.
Oh, what's going on? I wish I could explain the whole thing. This is a very complicated chess game with a new major player being Russia. And Putin has really taken his time. He's really set this up very carefully. He's had lots of meetings with various leaders in the Middle East. And now Russia is running a small but highly publicized little air campaign out of Syria. Their goal is to back President Assad or give him some breathing space. It's turning into a really interesting move. I think this is Russia moving to become possibly a major player and a Middle East power broker.
Well, that changes everything. I mean, we didn't expect. When we were training the rebels, we never thought of this. We never thought of Iran. And I think that we've even gone out and not in support of Assad because of his human being, he bombed the Kurds, if I'm not mistaken, or poisoned them. And so what did France tell Putin as far as limiting his airstrikes to only Islamic State targets? Now, how did that get in?
Right. Well, the idea is that the Russian Air Force will help by striking the Islamic State targets. And, of course, that is what the U.S. and coalition are already doing in Syria. So this is something, Bob, that I haven't seen ever before. Can't think of another time in history. We've got both Russia and the U.S. And Western and regional allies waging air campaigns in Syria. The skies of Syria are pretty busy. So the question, though, is how accurate and how honest the Russians are being. We really don't know. They are certainly striking some Islamic State targets, but it looks like they're doing some other things as well. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what Russia has going on in Syria. They've got between 20 and 30 military aircraft, a real mix of some older Su-24, Su-25 fighters, and some of their newer fighter bombers as well. They pulled up to a lovely little base at Latakia, which is on the Mediterranean coast of Syria, just a little bit south of Turkey, north of Lebanon, a real pretty town. They're supplying in there, building their tent cities, running the chow hall and the armaments dump, just like everybody does with an air base. And from there, they are undertaking strikes against various targets. What's interesting to me is it's pretty much they're keeping banker's hours on this air campaign. It's a couple strikes here, a couple strikes there. as our Air Commander, U.S. Air Force General, Lieutenant General Charles Brown, called Charlie Brown, says, you know, the fact is the U.S. and our allies are flying much more than the Russians are in Syria. So while the Russians are there, they're getting a lot of headlines, but their actual activity is a little bit lower tempo than what the U.S. and its allies are doing right now.
Well, I see that we did warn Russia against striking non-ISIS, right, did I get that? Yeah, ISIS groups in Syria. Is that warning still in effect, or do we just kind of bro that and say we got to do something else? What's going on?
I think that warning is still in effect, and remember that with our great intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, that's aircraft, unmanned drones, satellites, all sorts of other methods, we have a pretty good sense, most likely, of where the Russians are striking. I don't think our commanders are necessarily making that information public, but my sense is they are keeping close watch on the Russian campaign, so they'll know where the bombs are falling. But the issue in Syria for the U.S. and for our allies, too, has been, what are the right targets to hit? You know, do we know that we're really hitting a little cluster of Islamic State fighters? Do we know if we see a hut, is it the right folks? There have been a lot of strikes against relatively small tactical targets, and it really just depends on having the right battlefield information to know if you're hitting something important to the bad guys or not. The difference with Russia, because they are cooperating with the Syrian regime, is they are able to use the intelligence of the Syrian army in part to decide where their strikes will be. That's not something the U.S. and its allies are doing. So it's a really different, mixed, muddled situation going on in Syria today.
I'm going to tell all my audience, raise your hand, all those that really, truly understand all of this. And to keep all of this together, you do need a playbook. Here we have today, in today's news, Turkey shoots down drone near Syria. Unmarked, unidentified drone. What was all that about?
What a good question. Exactly. Bob, I know you're always interested in drones, which really are a mark of current warfare. I took a look at the picture of the wreckage. It's a small drone. People agree that it's of Russian design or Russian manufacture. The trouble is those drones are pretty widely circulated, and it could have come from anyone. It could be a Hezbollah drone. It could be, who knows. But I think that most likely, though Russia has denied it, it most likely is a Russian drone that they would have been using for reconnaissance. We don't really know for sure, but I think that's the most likely
case. But isn't that a little dangerous to be flying drones, things that are flying around with that? Couldn't that trigger a definite problem? I'm seeing there's a lot of airspace, but there's also a lot of things going out there. What about that possibility?
There are a lot of things in there. And back during Iraq, you know, our C-130 pilots would refer to our own drones in the pattern as the flying toaster. Get that flying toaster out of my way. I'm on short final here. So the Turks were well within their rights in shooting this drone down. They said they hailed it three times. Turkey's got a great, very modern Air Force. Of course, Turkey, a NATO ally. They fly the F-4. They fly F-16, superb fighter pilots. And I think the drones probably are more of a danger right now than the Russian fighter bombers are. And it can be hard when you have a drone. You don't know who's controlling it. And it really depends on the fighter pilot, in this case the Turks, either seeing that drone outside the cockpit, so picking it up on visual, or using radar or some other method to find out that drone is there. And that's new stuff. That's a little tough. So there's a question about just about air safety and management. I think the other thing, too, of course, is you know, the news has reported that some of our U.S. jets came within about 20 miles of some Russian jets who were off on their afternoon air campaign. And that's not quite as worrying because our U.S. fighter pilots have two really good ways to watch for the Russians. One, of course, is visual, and the other is from sensors on the aircraft. They can also link into other command and control aircraft, whether those are unmanned or big radar planes like AWACS that can keep an eye on the space. So our U.S. fighter pilots are really good at watching for other aircraft in the area. And if they're within, you know, 20 miles is not a big deal to them. They can sometimes pick them up on visual, especially since I'm getting the sense the Russians are preferring to operate often in daylight. And the fact remains the U.S. and our allies are just flying much, much, much more. So they've got a good grip on that airspace. But the drones, they are a bit of a wild card.
Well,
if I could just add, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, historically, if there's any equivalent to what we're looking at. And the thing that really comes to my mind, you know, you think about the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, and the Germans were providing pilots and planes, became
excellent.
What we call the Condor
yep.
region. And, you know, and here was potential for another world war, yet, you know, the Spanish Civil War was both the Soviets and the Germans contributing advisors and troops and pilots, you know, how tenuous it was, but yet it didn't explode into a world war that was going to occur, you know, years later. And so it's not always where there's potential for that kind of thing to happen. It isn't always a straight line.
Kevin, you're so right. What a great comparison to the Spanish Civil War. And just from the aircraft side, back in the Spanish Civil War, we saw some innovative use of aircraft by both sides, and we're seeing a little bit of that with the Russians, with presumably their drones. They haven't done an air campaign in a very, very, very long time, and they've brought some newer equipment out. Some people say they're testing out their Sukhoi Su-34 bombers and some of their other things, so I think they are certainly going to be learning a lot from their operations there. It's a great comparison, Kevin.
It's just like the Germans did with the Luftwaffe, learning the weaknesses of their airplanes and, you know, upgrading from there.
That's right. They're testing it out. And I think we can't forget both the sort of military adventurism in that and then, of course, the fact that this air campaign of Putin's is playing big to a domestic audience. He has always had a very strong base of support with the military and just as important with the aircraft plants and the workers at the tank factories. Putin has always courted that group, and so he'll be covered in glory for waging this air campaign in Syria.
I see where the U.S. has already committed the other day to keeping troops past 2016. We've got about a minute and a half before we go on the next break. Dr. Grant, tell us about that.
You're talking about keeping troops in Afghanistan.
Yes. Yes.
The president reluctantly said that he felt that some troops needed to stay. I think it's important, and Kevin can comment. So those troops are going to include a large number, I believe, of special forces and also the air controllers that can keep an eye and keep some overwatch. But Kevin, what would you think those troops would include as they stay on in Afghanistan?
I think mostly soldiers that are going to be training, standing up the rest of the Afghan army like they've been doing for the last few years. And if what I understand is correct, with those troops on the ground, because, you know, there are inevitable times where they've encountered combat, especially in the recent attack by the Taliban, and with those boots on the ground in American uniforms, that almost that kind of allows for more air support, whereas when it's, you know, the Afghan army alone, there's certain rules of engagement that don't always apply. But in my latest, you know, research on this, that because there were American soldiers in Kunduz up north, that allowed for more superior air support, I guess I would call it. And, you know, I see this as a wise move by the president. I'm very low on this totem pole here, but I know it's not something he was excited about doing. His goal has been to, you know, draw down the American troops in Afghanistan, but I think he, you know, kind of used the flexibility of his office to say no, that the situation on the ground does not really allow for this right now. And I know that he was in, you know, he listened to his military advisors and very cautiously and after a lot of very sober thought decided to keep that contingent in there.
Good. Well, with that, we're going to conclude this portion of Veterans Radio. Don't go away. We're not gone yet. We're going to come back for the last segment right after this very important message. Don't go away. We got Dr. Rebecca Grant, Kevin Hemel, more on, oh, boy, my favorite subject to Korea. Coming up, Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. I don't know what that is, but somebody is getting that last beat in there. We're talking right now with Dr. Rebecca Grant, spokesperson for the Air Force and one of the think tanks for the Air Force, and Kevin Hemel, who's now a journalist for the Air Force, getting his wings, so to speak. And we're talking about, well, we were talking about Afghanistan with Dr. Grant. Dr. Grant is the spokesperson for the Air Force, and she has so much information. One of the things that Dr. Grant and I have been covering for the last few years, North Korea and Kim Jong-un, he vows his nation is ready to counter the U.S. threat. Oh, what's he going to do? Tell us all about that.
Oh, I wish I knew what he was going to do next. So the latest news, of course, is North Korea won't do anything about nuclear development, but now they're demanding a peace treaty with the U.S. to end the conflict. It's just sort of one more step in this long, ongoing saga that has, of course, gotten more critical and dangerous in recent years because of North Korea's successful tests of longer-range missiles and of our really growing suspicion that they, in fact, may already be in possession of nuclear weapons or be very, very close to that. So that's part of the concern, certainly, Bob.
How close is Kim Jong-un to China? I don't mean, politically.
Well, that's a relationship we all wish we understood, North Korea and China. I mean, they are very close, and we have almost no visibility into that relationship. We like to think that China, in the end, is the parent who is giving mischievous North Korea a long leash, but always has the ability to spank them or call a halt when things get out of control. But there are those who wonder whether that's really the case. Does China really have that much control over North Korea? And I think for most people, the scariest notion is that the leadership of North Korea is just incredibly unpredictable, insular. He's clearly a very odd man and not interested in rules-based international society. So the rogue factor is particularly high when we talk about North Korea.
Well, they just had a huge, in fact, they have two young people in the studio with me today, communications convention, the largest in the world in North Korea, was held in North Korea, the largest in the world. What do you call those, tablets and, you know, all that new stuff that's out there being held in North Korea. I watched MASH the other night, and oh Lord, North, what is going on? I know they are becoming. Tell us about that.
Well, I'd be interested to know, what Kevin thinks about this as well. But I think North Korea stages quite a bit of this. But the basic message is North Korea is no longer just, goats and farmers and very backwards. There really is some high technology there, and they really do have long-range missiles, the ability to put objects into orbit, which means they can launch longer-range ballistic missiles. And, of course, that's a little scary for us here in the United States, but it's very intimidating for our close allies in the region, particularly Japan and, of course, South Korea itself. We know that demilitarized zone simply bristles with weaponry, all the rumors about underground tunnels and artillery. It's a very tough problem. And sort of back of that is the question about what if North Korea's government falls but leaves a terrible humanitarian crisis in place. So it's really a conundrum, advancing technology but not the political maturity that we'd all like to see in North Korea.
No, we don't talk about political stuff much at all. No, we don't. We on this program. What we want to talk is like the Air Force response, et cetera. So when I look at this whole Korean situation, they're dangerous. That's a danger. They're so close to Japan. They're so, wow.
Well, if I could just, I'll just jump in real quick. You know, Dr. Grant, I'm glad you mentioned the thing about the tunneling, because that was a big effort by the North Koreans in the 1960s when we were so involved in Vietnam. They were constantly trying to distract us, and I know tunneling underneath the border was one of their main efforts. But I think some bright spots, you know, I think that the South Korean army is much more formidable than it was when it was first formed in the early 1950s. You know, we kind of built it almost out of scratch during the war, even though we had advisors right before the Korean War. And as the war went on, they really developed into a professional force, which exists today. That's, I think, one big positive in the region is the strength of the South Korean army. And, you know, even though we have had tensions and almost a detente with North Korea since the end of the war, you know, back in 2005, 2006, and even earlier than that, you know, we had negotiations with the North Koreans that let American teams into parts of North Korea to look for the bodies of American missing in actions and KIAs during the war. And, you know, teams would excavate certain areas, send remains to Hawaii where they are examined by a joint force that would use DNA technology to research and find who these servicemen were from the Korean War and identify them and tell their families. And that was something I covered working for Army Magazine. I thought was very important, and I would love to see something like that happen again despite all these tensions in that region.
Well, you know, it's very interesting as we look. I have been following militarily with Iran and all the difficulty that we had there with the hostages, et cetera. And here they come back and they become a proxy for us against the war against ISIS. And now we have North Korea becoming a power. And, well, who's left? China. Okay, let's talk about China. Dr. Grant, China and their development of the drone. How does this enter in all this in the equation?
Well, as you've said, North Korea, technological developments, and Kevin's so right to point out the great strength of the Republic of Korea Armed Forces. And in fact, you know, we've turned over a lot of the command and control to the South Korean Army, and they're a great outfit. And of course, China, on a very, very, very fast track. We talked about looking at some of Russia's new planes and their operations in Syria, but really there's no question that Russia is moving out fast. And of course, what China is doing at the moment is trying to reclaim little reefs across the Pacific and make them into islands. I heard our Secretary of Defense, Dr. Ashton Carter, say just because you take a reef and put some dirt on it doesn't mean you've got sovereign territory. So the U.S. has been very clear that China's land reclamation in the Pacific needs to stop. Why are they doing that at Fiery Cross and other areas? We all think that China's goal is to build airstrips in that area that they can use to exert air superiority and then sea superiority over some of the contested island areas, both down around the Philippines and up in the East China Sea, closer to Japan. So they are quiet but moving at a steady tempo, as always, in their military developments.
Well, so we said, don't do this. What if, are they still doing it, or are they... What has happened as a result of that? Don't do that. I mean, where do we stand right now? Is China still kind of thumbing their nose? We're going to do what we want to do, or what's the story?
Yeah, China carries on with this work, and they have said it's all peaceful. This is, you know, part of Peaceful Rise, and they've certainly made their sovereignty claims known. So it remains a real challenge for us, and certainly I think, you know, those in the Pentagon and both with the Army, very interestingly, has upgraded their position so that General Vincent Brooks there now is a four-star. They've really focused more towards China. And, you know, the whole military watches China very closely. The Navy, of course, very heavily involved, Air Force as well. So we watch not only their technical developments of drones. They have a heavy shipbuilding program underway, not only the carrier, of course, but some cruiser types and destroyer types. And they continue to build advanced aircraft, some of which are manned aircraft, and, Bob, some of which are
drones.
Yeah.
Yes.
They want a full suite of very advanced military capability.
Now, there has been an effort to ban drones. Where has that effort gone?
That effort has gotten stalled a bit at the UN. I think, you know, it's just like anything. There are some excellent uses for drones. You know, we use drones here domestically to assist with firefighting,
I know.
Surveillance, et cetera. So that effort is with the UN, but I don't think it will ever attract the support. The technology is moving far too fast to look at a ban on drugs.
Well, one of the things that you and I had talked about in past programs, and I still like this, they could, you launch so many drones from so many areas that you just can't shoot them all down, folks. Hundreds. What about that scenario? We've only got a few minutes. I know I've asked you that before, but I'd certainly like to have that answered again. Drones coming by the hundreds of thousands. What about that scenario?
Number one option for that right now is looking at directed energy weapons. And Kevin probably knows about this, but the Army is very involved in directed energy laser weapons research for defensive purposes. And there are discussions about how to put that capability not only on our attack helicopters like Apache, but potentially also on a Stryker vehicle when they miniaturize the systems a bit more. So the idea for defeating drones is to use a directed energy, very precise directed energy laser as part of the system.
And that system is being developed, correct?
Yes, there are several companies that are working on those. The Army is working on it. The Navy is working on it as well. The Air Force is working on applications to go on potentially fighters, bombers, gunships. So I think 5 years from now, Bob, you and I will be talking about with Kevin here about the deployment of lasers potentially with Stryker and the great progress that directed energy has made in the battle space.
And we can also be talking about catching some grouper down in Florida at the same time in 5 years. I don't know if I'll still be in Michigan. But anyway, Dr. Grant, thank you again. And you know, we always have you on the program at the beginning of the year, the end of the year, to wrap it all up. It's been tradition. I'd like to invite you again. Please come back. Is that all right? At the end of December, last week of December, the first week of January, set the tone. Will you be with us?
I'd love to do it again, Bob. Great idea.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grant. Oh, and there will be something from Zingerman's. Check the mail in a couple days. And Kevin, I want to say to you, thank you very much for being a new co-host and host. So welcome to Veterans. Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio. Welcome to being part of the crew.
Always glad to be here, Bob.
Okay, 30 seconds to go. Don't forget, folks, next week, I'm going to be back next week. That's right. We got all kinds of interesting things to be talking about right here on Veterans Radio. Don't forget, on October the 22nd, to go to Michigan Works, 304 Harriet Street in Ypsilanti. For all those in southeast Michigan, you can get your hair cut, you can get clothes, you can learn how to interview, you can do your get a job, you can get your resume, etc., etc. Oh, we got 10, 9, 8. Countdown. Don't forget, you are dismissed until next week.